real reason for his submersion in research over the last 2 months. He was avoiding the decision he must soon make, whether or not to return to the Shinzawe estate for Katala. Malamba knew there was a chance she had become the wife of another, for their separation had been nearly 5 years, and she would have no reason to think he'd ever be returning. But time and training had done nothing to dull his feelings toward her. As he reached the transporting room with its tiled pattern, he made his decision. Tomorrow he would go to see her. As he entered the room, he saw Hocho Pepper step off the pattern in the tile floor.
"Ah," said the plump magician, "there you are. Since it has been 2 weeks since I last saw you, I decided to pay a visit."
"I am glad to see you. I have been deeply involved in study and could do with a short respite." They walked from the room into one of the several gardens nearby. Hocho Pepper said,
"I have been meaning to ask you, what is the significance of the pattern you chose? I don't recognize it."
Malamba said, "It is a stylized recreation of a pattern I once saw in a fountain. 3 dolphins.
"Dolphins?"
Malamba explained about the Midkimian sea mammals while they seated themselves upon cushions between a pair of dwarf fruit trees.
"Why the dolphins from that fountain?"
"I don't know. A compulsion, perhaps. Also, when I underwent my final testing on the tower, I saw something that didn't register for a month or two after."
"What does one have to do with the other?"
"In the representation of the final challenge to the stranger, do you remember a single brown-robed magician who bent the rift to keep Keliwan from entering the enemy's universe?" Hocho Pepper looked thoughtful.
"I can't say as I do, Malamba. But then the spell used to create that image affects each of us differently. If you compare visions with others, you'll discover a great deal of variation. But at the time of the stranger, we were all black robes. Who could this odd brown-robed magician be?"
Malamba said, "A man I have met years ago."
"Impossible. That scene took place centuries ago."
Malamba smiled and said, "Nevertheless, I have met him. I made my pattern of 3 dolphins as something of a commemorative to our meeting."
"How very strange. There has been some speculation on time travel, which would have to be the answer in this case, unless your barbaric mind played false with you upon the tower."
He said the last with a smile. Malamba clapped his hands, and a servant arrived with a platter of refreshments. The servant, Nitoha, at one time had been Hadonra for the family that resided there previously. Malamba had found him while securing someone to plant the varieties of vegetation he wanted in his gardens. The man was bold enough to approach, something that singled him out from the common Surani. Unable to find the work he was trained for since the demise of his employer's estate, Nitoha had scratched out a meager living over the years. Malamba had taken him on as much out of sympathy as out of any real need. He had quickly made himself useful in 100 ways the young magician had never dreamed of, and the relationship was mutually satisfactory. Hocho Pepper took the offered sweets and drink.
"I have come to tell you some news. There is to be an imperial festival in 2 months' time, with games. Will you come?"
Malamba found his curiosity piqued. With a wave, he dismissed Nitoha. "And what makes this festival so special? I can't remember having seen you so animated before."
"This festival is being given by the warlord in honor of his nephew, the Emperor. He has plans for a new major offensive the week before the games, and it is hoped he will announce the success of the campaign."
He lowered his voice.
It is no secret to those with access to court gossip he is under a great deal of pressure to justify his conduct of the war before the High Council. Rumor has it he has been forced to offer major concessions to the Blue Wheel Party to regain their support in the war. But what will make the games unusual is that the light of heaven will leave his palace of contemplation, breaking with ancient tradition. It would be a proper occasion for you to make some sort of entrance into court society.
I'm sorry, Hocho, Melamba said. I have little desire to attend any festivals. I have been to one earlier this month in Ontoset as part of my studies. The dances are boring. The food tends toward the awful, and the wine is as flat as the speeches. The games are of less interest still. If this is the court society you speak of, then I'll be fine without it.
Melamba, there are many holes left in your education. Gaining the black robe did not mean instant mastery of our craft. There is quite a bit more involved in protecting the empire than sitting about dreaming up new ways of tossing energy around, or creating economic chaos with the local moneylenders.
He took another sweet and returned to his chiding.
There are several reasons you must come with me to the festivities, Melamba. First, you are something of a celebrity to the nobles of the realm, for news of your wondrous house has spread from one corner of the empire to the other, mostly by aid of those young bandits you paid so well to execute the delicate paintings you love so much. It is now considered the mark of some distinction to have the same sort of work done. And this place,
his hand inscribed an arc before them, mock wonder upon his face.
Anyone who could be so clever to design such an edifice must surely be worthy of attention.
His mocking tone vanished as he added,
By the way, this entire bit of nonsense has not been diminished one whit by your mysterious isolation here in the hinterlands. If anything, it has added to your reputation. Now, to more important reasons than social ones. As you no doubt know, there is growing concern that the news from the war is somehow being downplayed. In all these years there has been little gain, and some talk is going about that the Emperor may take a stand against the warlord's policies. If so,
he let the thought go unfinished. Melamba was silent for a time. Hocho, I think it is time that I told you something, and if you feel it sufficient to warrant my life, then you may return to the assembly and bring charges. Hocho Pepper was raptly attentive, all quips and sharp remarks put aside.
You who trained me did your work well, for I am filled with a need to do what is best for the empire. I hold only a little feeling for the land of my birth any more, and you will never know what that signifies. But in the process of making me what I am, you could never create the love of home within my being that I once felt for my own Kreidi. What you have created is a man with a strong sense of duty, untempered by any love for that thing he feels duty toward.
Hocho Pepper remained silent as the impact of what Melamba had said penetrated. Then he nodded as Melamba continued.
I may be the greatest threat to the Empire since the stranger invaded your skies, for if I become involved with its politics, I will be justice without mercy. I have known of the factions within the parties, the crossover of families from one party to another, and the consequences of those acts. Do you think because I sit atop my hill in the Eastlands, I am unaware of the shifts and stirrings of the political animals in the capital? Of course not. If the Blue Wheel Party collapses and its members realign with the War Party or the Imperials,
Every street merchant in Ontoset is speculating on the news the next day in the marketplace. I know what is taking place as well as any other who is not directly involved. And in the months since I came to live here, I have come to one conclusion. The Empire is slowly killing itself. The older magician said nothing for a moment, then asked, Have you wondered at all why our system is such that we are killing ourselves? Melamba stood and paced a little. Of course, I am studying it and have chosen to wait before I act. I need more time to understand the history you taught me so well. But I do have some speculations of sorts on what's wrong, and they will give me a starting point. He inclined his head, asking if he should go on. Hocho Pepper nodded that he should. It seems to me there are several major problems here. Problems I can only guess at in terms of impact upon the Empire. First, he held up his index finger, those in power are more concerned with their own grandeur than with the well-being of the Empire. And as they are those who appear to the casual eye to be the Empire, it is an easy thing not to notice. What do you mean? The older magician asked. When you think of the Empire, what comes to mind? A history of armies warring across the lands? Or the rise of the Assembly? Perhaps you think of a chronicle of rulers. Whatever it is, most likely the single most obvious truth is overlooked. The Empire is all those who live within its borders, from the nobles to the lowest servant, even the slaves who work the fields. It must be seen as a whole, not as being embodied by some small but visible part, such as the warlord or the High Council. Do you understand that? Hocho Pepper looked troubled. I'm not sure, but I think... Go on. If that is true, then consider the rest. Second, there must never be a time when the need for stability overrules the need for growth. But we have always grown, objected Hocho Pepper. Not true, countered Melamba. You have always expanded, and that seems like growth if you don't investigate closely. But while your armies have been bringing new lands into your borders, what has happened to your art, your music, your literature, your research? Even the vaunted assembly does little more than refine that which is already known. You implied earlier that I was wasting my time finding new ways to toss energy around. Well, what is wrong with that? Nothing. But there is something wrong with the type of society that looks upon the new as suspect. Look around you, Hocho. Your artists are in shock because I described what I had seen in paintings in my youth, and a few young artists became excited. Your musicians spend all their time learning the old songs perfectly to the note, and no one composes new ones, just clever variations on melodies that are centuries old. No one creates new epics. They only retell old ones. Hocho, you are a people stagnating. This war is but one example. It is unjustified, fought from habit, to keep certain groups in power, to reap wealth for those already wealthy, and to play the game of the council. And the cost! Thousands of lives are wasted each year. The lives of those who are the Empire, its own citizens. The Empire is a cannibal, devouring its own people. The older magician was disturbed by what he heard, in total contradiction with what he believed he saw, a vibrant, energetic, alive culture. Third, said Melamba, if my duty is to serve the Empire, and the social order of the Empire is responsible for its own stagnation, then it is my duty to change that social order, even if I must destroy it. Now Hocho Pepper was shocked. Malamba's logic was without fault, but the suggested solution was potentially fraught with danger to everything Hocho Pepper knew and revered.
I understand what you say, Malamba, but what you speak of is too difficult to contemplate all at once.
Malamba's voice took on reassuring tones. I do not mean to imply that the destruction of the present social order is the only solution, Hocho.
I use that to shock and to drive home a point. That is what much of my research is about. Not only the visible mastery of energy, but also investigations into the nature of the Surani people and the Empire. Believe me, I am more than willing to spend as much time on the question as I need. I plan on spending some time in the archives.
Hocho Pepper's brows furrowed, and he studied his younger friend's face.
Be warned. You may find some unsettling things in those archives. As I said, your education is not complete.
Malamba let his voice drop.
I have already found some unsettling things, Hocho. Much of what is held to be common truth by the nations is based upon falsehoods.
Hocho Pepper became concerned.
There are things that are forbidden for any but members of the assembly to know, Malamba, and even then it is unwise to speak about them to even one of your brethren.
He glanced away, thinking, then said,
Still, when you have finished prowling around in those musty old vaults, if you need to discuss your findings, I'll be a willing ear.
He looked back at his friend.
I like you, and think you're a refreshing change of pace for us, Malamba. But there are many who would rather see you dead as not. Don't go chattering on to anyone but Shimon or myself about this social research you're doing.
Agreed. But when I reach a judgment as to what must be done, I shall act. Hocho Pepper stood, an expression of concern on his face.
It is not that I disagree with you, my friend. It is simply that I must have time to assimilate what you have said.
I can only speak the truth to you, Hocho, no matter how disturbing.
Hocho Pepper smiled. A fact I appreciate, Malamba. I must spend some time considering the proposition.
Some of his usual humor crept back into his voice.
Perhaps you will accompany me to the assembly. You have been absent much of the time with this house building and all. You would do well to put in an appearance now and again.
Malamba smiled at his friend.
Of course.
He indicated that Hocho Pepper should lead the way to the pattern. As they walked, Hocho Pepper said,
If you wish to study our culture, Malamba, I still suggest you come to the Imperial Festival. There will be more political activity in the seats of the arena in that one day than could be observed in a month in the High Council.
Malamba turned toward Hocho Pepper.
Perhaps you're right. I shall think about it.
When they appeared on the pattern of the assembly, Shimon was standing close by. He bowed slightly in greeting and said,
Welcome. I was about to go looking for you two.
Hocho Pepper said with mild amusement,
Are we so vital to the business of the assembly that you must be sent to fetch us back?
Shimon inclined his head a little.
Perhaps, but not today. I merely thought you would find the business at hand interesting.
Malamba asked, What is happening?
The warlord has sent messages to the assembly, and Hodikyu raises questions about them. We best hurry, for they are nearly ready to begin.
They walked quickly to the central hall of the assembly and entered. Arrayed about a large open area was an amphitheatre of open benches. They took seats in a lower row. Already several hundred black-robed great ones were in place. In the center of the floor they could see Fumita, the one-time brother of the Shinzawe lord, standing alone. He would be presiding over the business of the day. The presidency was allotted by chance to one of those in attendance. Melamba had seen Fumita in the assembly only twice since being brought here. Shimon said, "It has been nearly 3 weeks since I saw you in the assembly, Melamba." "I must apologize, but I have been busy getting my home in order."
"So I hear. You're something of a source of gossip in the imperial court. I hear the warlord himself is anxious to meet you."
"Perhaps someday." Hojo Pepper said to Shimon,
"Who can understand such a man, taking to building such a strange home?"
He turned to Melamba.
"Next you'll be telling me that you're taking a wife."
Melamba laughed.
"Why, Hojo, how did you guess?"
Hojo Pepper's eyes grew wide.
"You're not."
"And why shouldn't I?"
"Melamba, it is not a wise course, believe me. To this day, I have regretted my own marriage."
"Hojo, I didn't know you were a married man."
"I choose not to speak of it much. My wife is a fine woman, though given to an overly sharp tongue and scathing wit. In my own home, I'm not much more than another servant to be ordered about. That is why I see her only on prescribed holidays. It would be bad for my nerves to see her more often."
Shimon said,
"Who is your intended, Melamba? A noble daughter?"
"No. She was a slave with me at the Shinzawe estate."
Hojo Pepper mused. "A slave girl? That might work out."
Melamba laughed, and Shimon chuckled. Several other magicians regarded them with curiosity, for the assembly was not a regular forum for mirth. Fumita held up his hand, and the assembly became quiet.
"Today there is a matter being brought before the assembly by Hodikyu."
A thin great one, with shaved head and hooked nose, walked from his seat in front of Melamba and Hojo Pepper to the center of the floor. He surveyed the magicians in the hall, then spoke.
"I come today so that I may speak about the Empire."
It was the formal opening of any business brought before the assembly.
"I speak for the good of the Empire," he added, completing the ritual. "I am concerned about the demand made today by the warlord for aid, so he may broaden the war against the Midkemian world."
A chorus of jeers and cries of "politics" and "sit down" erupted from around the room. Soon Shimon and Hojo Pepper were on their feet with others crying,
"Let him speak."
Fumita held up a hand for silence, and soon the room quieted. Hodikyu continued.
"We are precedented. 15 years ago, the assembly sent an order to the warlord to end the war against the Turil Confederation."
Another magician jumped to his feet.
"If the Turil conquest had continued, there would have been too few in the north to repulse the Thune migration that year. It was a clear case of the salvation of Zetak province and the Holy City. Now our borders in the north are secure. The situation is not the same."
Arguments erupted over the entire hall, and it took several minutes for Fumita to restore order. Hojo Pepper rose and said,
"I would like to hear Hodikyu's reasons for considering this request vital to the security of the Empire. Any magician who is willing is free to work on behalf of the conquest."
"That is the point," responded Hodikyu.
There is no reason for any magician who feels this war into another space-time is right and proper for the Empire not to work in support of the conquest. Without the Black Robes, who already serve the Warlord, the Rift would never have been prepared for such an undertaking. It is that he now makes demands of the Assembly itself I find objectionable. If 5 or 6 magicians choose to serve in the field, even to travelling to this other world to risk their lives in the battle, then it is their own concern. But if 1 magician responds to this demand without considering the issues, it will appear the Assembly is now subject to the will of the Warlord.
Several magicians applauded this sentiment, and others seemed to weigh its merits. Only a few booed and jeered. Hocho Pepper stood again.
I would like to offer a proposal. I will undertake on behalf of the Assembly to send a message to the Warlord expressing our regret that the Assembly, as a body, may not order any magician to perform as requested, but that he is free to seek the services of any magician willing to work on his behalf.
A general murmur of approval ran through the room, and Femita asked,
Hocho Pepper offers a proposition to send a statement of policy to the Warlord on behalf of the Assembly. Does anyone find this objectionable?
When no objections were forthcoming, he said,
The Assembly thanks Hocho Pepper for his wisdom.
He paused for a moment, then said,
Another matter needs our attention. The novice Shiro has been found lacking in the moral qualities necessary for the greater art. The mind probes reveal that he harbors anti-imperial feelings, learned as a youth from his maternal grandmother, a Tyrrell woman. Is the Assembly agreed?
Hands were raised, and each bore a nimbus of light as the magicians voted. Green for life, red for death, and blue for abstention. Melamba abstained, but the vote was otherwise unanimous for death. 1 black robe rose, and Melamba knew that within minutes the novice would be stunned senseless, then teleported to the bottom of the lake, where his lifeless body would remain, too cold to rise to the surface. After the meeting broke up, Shimon said,
You should make a point of coming more often, Melamba. We hardly see you anymore. And you spend too much time alone.
Melamba smiled. That is true, but I plan to remedy the situation tomorrow. The chime sounded throughout the house, and servants jumped to make ready for the Great One's visit. Kamatsu, Lord of the Shinzawe, knew that a Great One had struck a chime in the halls of the Assembly, willing the sound to come here to announce his imminent appearance. In Kasumi's room, Lori and the elder son of the house sat engrossed in a game of Peshawar, played with painted pieces of stiff paper. It was common to alehouses and inns in Mid-Kemia, and was one more detail in the young Surani's drive to master every facet of Mid-Kemian life. Kasumi stood.
It is most likely he who once was my uncle. I had best go.
Lori smiled.
Or could it be that you wish to stem your losses?
The Surani shook his head.
I fear I have created a problem in my own house. You were never a good slave, Lori, and if anything, you have grown more intractable. It is a good thing I like you.
They both laughed, and the elder son of the house left. A few minutes later, a house slave came running to Lori and informed him that the lord of the house commanded him to come at once. Lori jumped up, more from the slave's obvious agitation than from any inbred obedience. He hurried to the lord's room and knocked on the door jamb. The door slid to one side, and Kasumi held it. Lori stepped through and saw the Shinzawe lord and his guest, And then confusion overtook him. The guest was wearing the black robe of the Surani Great Ones, but the face was Pug's. He started to speak, stopped, and started again. Pug? The lord of the house looked outraged at this forward behavior by the slave, but his nearly voiced command was stopped by the Great One. May I have the use of this room for a few minutes, Lord? I wish to speak to this slave in private. Komatsu, Lord of the Shinzawe, bowed stiffly.
Your will, Great One.
He left the room with his son behind. He was still in shock over the appearance of the former slave and confused at the conflicts within himself. The Great One he was. There could be no thought of fraud. His manner of arrival proved it. But Komatsu couldn't help feeling that his arrival heralded disaster for the plan he and his son had so carefully nurtured for the last 9 years. Malamba spoke. Shut the door, Lorry. Lorry shut it, then studied his former friend. He looked fit, but vastly changed. His bearing was nearly regal, as if the mantle of power he now wore reflected some inner strength he had lacked before. Lorry began, then lapsed into silence, confused about what to say. Finally he said, Are you well? Malamba nodded. I am well, old friend. Lorry smiled and crossed the room and embraced his friend, then pushed himself away.
Let me look at you.
Malamba smiled. I am called Malamba, Lorry. The boy you knew as Pug is as dead as last year's flowers. Come, sit and we will talk. They sat at the table and poured two cups of chocha. Lorry sipped at the bitter brew and said,
We heard nothing about you.
After the first year, I gave you up for lost. I'm sorry.
Malamba nodded. It is the way of the assembly. As a magician, I am expected to forego all my former ties, except for those that can be maintained in a socially acceptable manner. Being without clan or family, I had nothing to forego. And you were always a poor slave who never knew his place. What better friend for a renegade barbarian magician? Lorry nodded.
I am glad you have returned. Will you stay?
Malamba shook his head no. I have no place here. Besides, there is work I must be about. I now have an estate of my own, near the city of Ontoset. I have come for you, and Katala, if... His voice trailed off, as if he were fearful of asking about her. Sensing his distress, Lorry said,
She is still here and has not taken a husband. She would not forget you.
He broke into a grin.
Gods of Midkemia, it completely slipped my mind. You would have no way of knowing.
What?
You have a son.
Malamba sat dumbstruck.
A son?
Lorry laughed.
He was born 8 months after you were taken. He is a fine boy, and Katala is a fine mother.
Malamba felt overwhelmed at the news and said,
Please, would you bring her here?
Lorry jumped to his feet.
At once.
He rushed from the room. Malamba sat fighting down the upsurge of emotion. He composed himself, using his magician's skills to relax his mind. The door slid open, and Katala was revealed. Uncertainty on her face. Lorry stood behind, a boy of about 4 in his arms. Malamba rose and spread his arms to her. Katala rushed to him, and he nearly cried in his joy. They clung quietly for a moment. Then she murmured,
I thought you'd gone.
I hoped.
But I thought you'd gone.
They stood for several minutes, each lost in the pure pleasure of the other's presence, until she pushed herself away.
You must meet your son, Pug.
Lorry brought the boy forward. He regarded Malamba with large brown eyes. He was a well-formed boy, with a stronger likeness to his mother. But something in the way he tilted his head made him resemble the boy from Cridy Keep. Katala took him from Lorry and passed him to Malamba.
William, this is your father.
The boy seemed to take this in with some skepticism. He ventured a shy smile, but leaned back, keeping his distance.
I want down,
he said abruptly. Malamba laughed and put the boy down. He looked at his father, then immediately lost interest in the stranger in black.
Ooh,
he cried, and rushed over to play with the Lord of the Shinzawe's shore pieces. Malamba watched him for a moment, then said,
William?
Katala stood next to him with her arm around his waist, hugging him as if afraid he would disappear again. Lorry said,
She wanted a Midkemian name for him, Malamba.
Katala started,
Malamba?
It is my new name, love. You must get used to calling me that. She frowned, not entirely pleased with the thought.
Malamba,
she repeated, testing the sound. She then shrugged.
It is a good name.
How did he become William? Lorry went over to the boy, who was trying to stand the pieces one atop the other, and gently took them away. The boy threw him a black look.
I want to play,
he said indignantly. Lorry picked him up and said,
I gave her a bunch of names, and she picked that one.
I liked its sound, she said.
William.
At the sound of his name, the boy looked at his mother.
I'm hungry.
I favoured James or Owen, but she insisted,
Lorry said, while the boy tried to wriggle out of his arms. Katala took him.
I must feed him. I'll take him to the kitchen.
She kissed Malamba and left the room. The magician stood quietly for a moment.
It is all more than I had hoped for. I was afraid she'd have found another.
Not that one, Malamba. She would have nothing to do with any of the men who paid court to her, and there were a few. She's a good woman. You need never doubt her.
I never will, Lorry.
They seated themselves. A discreet cough at the door made them turn. Komatsu stood at the door.
May I enter, Great One?
Malamba and Lorry started to rise, and the lord of the house waved them back into place.
Please, stay seated.
Kasumi entered behind his father and closed the door. Malamba noticed for the first time that the son of the house was wearing garments that were Midkemian in fashion. He raised an eyebrow, but said nothing. The head of the Shinzawe family looked deeply troubled and tried to collect his thoughts. After a few moments, he said,
Great one, may I be frank with you? Your arrival today is something unexpected and the source of some possible difficulty.
Please, said Malamba. I do not intend to cause disruption in your household, Lord. I want only my wife and son, and I will require this slave also.
He indicated Lorry.
Your will, Great One. The woman and the boy should, of course, go with you. But if I may beg of you, please allow the slave to remain.
Malamba looked from face to face. The two Shinzawe maintained control, but by the way they glanced from one to the other and at Lorry, their distress was poorly hidden. Something had changed here in the last 5 years. The relationship between the men in the room was not what it should have been between masters and slave.
Lorry, Malamba looked at his friend. What is this?
Lorry looked at the other two men, then at Malamba.
I will have to ask you to promise me something.
Komatsu's shock was signalled by a sharp intake of breath.
Lorry, you dare too much. One does not bargain with a great one. His words are as law.
Malamba held up a hand. No, let him speak. In imploring tones, Lorry said to his friend,
I know little of these matters, Malamba. You know I have no sense about protocol. I may be violating custom, but I ask you, for the sake of our former friendship, will you keep a trust and vow to keep what you hear in this room to yourself?
The magician pondered the matter. He could command the Shinzawe lord to tell all, and the man would, as automatically as a soldier following orders. But his friendship with the troubadour was important to him. I give you my word that I will not repeat what you tell me. Lorry gave a sigh and smile, and the Shinzawe seemed to lose some of their tension. Lorry said, I have struck a bargain with my lord here. When we have completed certain tasks, I am to be given my freedom. Malamba shook his head. That is not possible. The law does not permit a slave to be freed. Even the warlord cannot free a slave. Lorry smiled. And yourself? Malamba looked stern. I am outside the law. None may command me. Are you claiming to be a magician?
No, Malamba, nothing like that.
It is true that I can only be a slave here, but I won't be here. I will return to Midkemia. Malamba looked puzzled. How is that possible? There is only one rift into Midkemia, and that is controlled by the warlord's pet magicians. There are no others, or I would know of them.
We have a plan. It is involved and will take much explaining, but simply put, it is this. I will accompany Kasumi, disguised as a priest of Turakamu the Red. He will be leading soldiers replacing troops at the front. No one is likely to notice my height, for the Red One's priests are given wide berth. The troops are all loyal to the Shinzawe. Once in Midkemia, we will slip through the lines and find our way to the kingdom forces.
Malamba nodded.
Now I understand the language lessons and the clothes. But tell me, Lorry, are you willing to spy for the Surani in exchange for your freedom?
There was no disapproval in his voice. It was a simple question. Lorry flushed.
I am not going as a spy. I am going as a guide. I am to take Kasumi to Rilonon for an audience with the king.
Why? Malamba was surprised. Kasumi interrupted.
I go to meet the king and bring him an offer of peace.
Malamba raised an argument.
How can you possibly expect to end the war with a war party still in control of the High Council?
There is one thing in our favor, responded Komatsu. This war has lasted for 9 years, and the end is nowhere in sight. Great one, I don't presume to instruct you, but if I may explain some things?
Malamba nodded that he should continue. Komatsu sipped his drink and went on.
Since the end of the war with the Turil Confederation, the war party has been pressed to maintain its dominance over the High Council. Each border clash with Turil brought the call for a renewal of the conflict. Between the fighting on the border and the constant attempts by the Thun to break through the passes in the north and regain their former southern range, the war party managed barely to maintain a majority. A coalition led by the Blue Wheel Party was on the verge of dislodging them 10 years ago, when the Assembly discovered the rift into your former homeland. The call for war rang out in the Council as soon as the rich metals of your homeland were known to exist. All the progress we had made over the years was lost in that instant. So we began at once to counter this madness. The metals being mined on your former world are, from what Lorry has told us, the leavings of abandoned mines, not considered worth the bother by those you call dwarves. There is nothing in this for Suranuani but an excuse to raise the war banner again and shed blood. You know our history. You know how difficult it is for us to settle our differences in a peaceful manner. I have been a soldier and know the glories of war. I also know its waste. Lorry has convinced me that my suspicions about those who live in the kingdom were correct. You are not a very warlike people, in spite of your nobles and their armies. You would have been willing to trade. Malamba interrupted. This is all true, but I am not sure that it has any bearing on things as they stand now. My former nation had not fought a major war in nearly 50 years, except for skirmishes with the goblins of the north and along the Keshian border. But now the battle drums sound in the west. The armies of the kingdom have been blooded. The nation has been invaded without cause. They would not, I think, be willing simply to stop and forgive. There would be demands for retribution, or at least reparation. Would the High Council be willing to surrender the honor of Suranuani and make restitution for the wrong done at the hands of its soldiers? The Shinzawe lord looked troubled. The council would not, I am sure. But the emperor would. The emperor? Malamba said, surprised. What has he to do with this? Ichinda, may heaven bless him, feels the war is bleeding the empire of its resources. When we campaigned against the Turil, we learned that some frontiers are simply too vast and far from the empire to control, save at costs far greater than the victories are worth. The light of heaven understands that nowhere could there be a frontier as vast or far as that we have found on Midkemia. He is taking a hand in the game of the council. It is perhaps the greatest game ever played in the history of Suranuani. The Light of Heaven is willing to command the warlord to peace, to have him removed from office, if need be. But he will not take the risk of so great a break with tradition unless he is guaranteed the willingness of King Roderick to come to terms. He must go before the High Council with peace, a fait accompli. Otherwise, he risks too much. Regicide has been committed only once in the history of the Empire, Great One. The High Council hailed the killer and named him Emperor. He was the son of the man he slew. His father had tried to order taxes imposed upon the temples, the last time an emperor played in the game of the council. We can be a hard people, Great One, even with ourselves. And never has an emperor sought to do what Ichinda seeks, what others, many others, will see as laying down the honor of the empire, an unthinkable act. But if he can deliver peace to the council, then it will clearly show the gods give their blessing to such an undertaking, and none will dare challenge him. You risk much, Lord of the Shinzawe. I love my nation and the Empire, Great One. I would willingly die in the field for her, and I risked that often when I was younger, during the Turil campaigns. I would also risk my life, my sons, the honor of my house, family, and clan to bring the Empire to sanity, as would the Emperor. We are a patient people. This plan is years in preparation. The Blue Wheel Party has long been secretly allied with the Party for Peace. We withdrew in the third year of the war to embarrass the warlord and set the stage for Kasumi's training for the coming journey. Over a year was spent in traveling to various lords within the Blue Wheel and Peace parties,
ensuring cooperation, that every member would play his part in the game of the council, before you and Laurie were brought here to be his tutors. We are Surani, and the light of heaven would not allow an overture to be made until he had a ready messenger. We have made Kasumi that messenger, seeking to give him the best possible chance of reaching your former king safely. It must be this way, for should any outside our faction learn of the attempt, if it fails, many heads, including my own, would fall. The price of losing the game. If you take Laurie away, Kasumi has little chance of reaching your former king, and the peace effort will be postponed until we can find another trustworthy guide. A delay almost certain to last one or two more years. The situation is now critical. The Blue Wheel Party is again part of the Alliance for War, after years of negotiation with the War Party, and thousands of men are being sent to fight so that Kasumi may slip through kingdom lines into your former homeland. The time will soon be ripe. You must consider what even another year of war would mean. With the conquest of your former homeland, the warlord could become invulnerable to any move we may make. Malamba considered. Then to Kasumi said, "How soon?" Kasumi said, "Soon, Great One. A matter of weeks. The warlord has spies everywhere and has some hint of our plans. He has little trust of the Blue Wheel's sudden shift in the council. But he cannot refuse the aid. He feels the need to strike a great victory. He plans the major spring offensive against the forces of Lords Boric and Brukhall, the kingdom's main strength. It will be timed to occur just before the Imperial Festival, orchestrated so he can announce the victory at the Imperial Games for his own personal glory." Komatsu said, "It is much like an endgame gambit in shore, Great One. A smashing victory will gain the warlord all he needs to take control of the High Council, but we risk this to play for our final move. The front will be in confusion as preparations are being made for the offensive. Kasumi and Laurie will have their best opportunity to slip through the lines. Should King Roderick agree, then the light of heaven can appear in the High Council with an announcement of peace, and all that the warlord's power and influence is based upon will crumble. In terms of sure, we expose our last piece to capture so that our emperor may checkmate a warlord." Malamba was thoughtful for a time. "I think you have embarked on a bold plan, Lord of the Shinzawe. I will honor my pledge to say nothing. Laurie may continue here." He looked at Laurie. "May the gods of our forefathers protect you and bring you success. I pray this war may end soon." He stood up. "If you don't mind, I will take my leave. I would have my wife and child home now." Kasumi rose and bowed. "I should like to say one thing more, Great One." Malamba indicated he should proceed. "Years ago, when you asked for Katala for your wife, and I told you the request would be refused, I also told you there was a reason. It was our plan you would also return to your homeworld. I trust you understand that now. We are a hard people, Great One, but not cruel." It was apparent as soon as the plan was revealed. He looked at Laurie. "For what I am now, this is my homeland. But there is still a part of me unchanged within. And for that reason, I envy you your homecoming. You will be well remembered, old friend." So saying, Malamba left the room. Outside the great house, he found Katala waiting in a garden, watching their son at play. She came to him and they embraced, savoring sweet reunion.
After a long moment, he said, "Come, beloved, let us take our son home." Chapter 9. Fusion. Longbow wept in silence. Alone in a glade near the edge of the elven forests, the huntmaster of Kreide stood over 3 fallen elves. Their lifeless bodies lay sprawled upon the ground with arms and legs bent at impossible angles, their fair faces covered in blood. Martin knew what death meant to the elves, where 1 or 2 children to a family in a century was the norm. One face he knew well, Algavin's, Galain's companion since boyhood, less than 30 years of age, still a child by the elven folk's measure. Footsteps from behind caused Martin to wipe away the tears and resume his usually impassive expression. From behind, he heard Garrett say, "There's another bunch down the trail, Huntmaster. The Serrani went through this part of the forest like a bad wind." Martin nodded, then set out without comment. Garrett followed. For all his youth, Garrett was Longbow's best tracker, and they both moved lightly along the trail toward Elvander. After traveling for hours, they crossed the river west of a Serrani enclave, and when they were safely into the elven forests, a voice hailed them from the trees. "Well met, Martin Longbow." Martin and Garrett halted and waited as 3 elves appeared from among the trees, seemingly forming out of the air. Galain and his 2 companions approached the huntmaster and Garrett. Martin inclined his head slightly back toward the river, and Galain nodded. It was all the communication they needed to exchange the fact both knew of Algavin's death, along with the others. Garrett noticed the exchange, though he was far from conversant with the subtleties of elvish ways.
"Thomas? Kaelin?" asked Martin.
"In council with the Queen. Do you bring news?"
"Messages from Prince Arutha. Are you bound for council?"
Galain smiled the elvish half-smile that indicated ironic humor.
"It has fallen to us to guard the way. We must remain for a time. We will come as soon as the dwarves cross the river. They are due any time now."
The comment was not lost on Martin as he bade them goodbye and continued toward Elvander. Approaching the clearing surrounding the elvish tree city, he wondered at the exclusion of Galain and the other young elves from council. They were all constant companions of Thomas since he came to take up permanent residency in Elvander. Martin had not been there since just before the siege of Kreide, but in those years he had spoken to some of the Natalie's rangers, who ran messages from the Duke to Elvander to Kreide. On several occasions he had spent hours talking with Long Leon and Grimsworth of Natal. While close-mouthed when not among their own kind, they were less guarded with Longbow, for in the Huntmaster of Kreide they sensed a kindred spirit. He was the only man not a ranger of Natal who could enter Elvander unbidden. The 2 Natalie's rangers had indicated great changes in the Elf Queen's court, and Martin felt a strange sort of silent disquiet. As they approached Elvander in an easy, loping run, Garrett said,
"Huntmaster, will they not send someone to fetch the fallen?"
Martin stopped and leaned upon his bow.
"Garrett, it is not their way. They will let the forest reclaim them, for they believe their true spirits are now abiding in the Blessed Isles."
He thought for a moment, then said,
"Among my trackers, you are perhaps the best I've known."
The still young man blushed at the compliment, but Longbow said,
"No flattery, but simply fact. I mention it because you are the one most likely to replace me should anything happen."
Garrett's usual hangdog expression gave way to one of close attention to what Martin was saying. Martin continued,
If something should occur that takes me from this life, I would hope that someone would continue to keep Elvander and the human world from drifting apart.
Garrett nodded. I think I understand.
You must, for it would be a sad thing for the two races to grow away from one another.
He spoke softly.
About their beliefs you must learn as you can. But a few things you should know, especially in this time of war. Do you remember how it is claimed that certain priests can recall the dead if they are no more than an hour departed?
Garrett said, I have heard the story, but I have never met anyone who claims to have seen it done, or even claims to know someone who has seen it.
It is true. Father Tully says so, and he's not the sort to be less than forthright on matters of faith.
Martin looked down at the soil.
There is a story. An important priest, of which order I do not know, found himself grown away from the gods and caught up in the human world. He cast off his fine robes and golden ornaments and donned the simple homespun of an itinerant monk. He wandered the wilderness, seeking humility. Time and chance brought him to Elvander, where he came upon a newly fallen elf, dead by accident, but a few minutes before the priests arrived.